Janet kept a close eye on Penny and shushed him whenever he looked like he might be about to say something.
"Let it make the first move," she whispered.
"Freak show," Josh said. "What is that thing?"
"It's a dryad, idiot."
"I thought those were girl trees."
"They're supposed to be sexy girl trees," Josh said plaintively.
"And I thought dryads were oaks," Alice said. "That's a birch."
"What makes you think it's not a girl tree?"
"Whatever it is," Josh said under his breath, "it's pay dirt. Fucking tree thing, man. Pay fucking dirt."
The tree was a fast walker, almost bouncing along on its springy, knee-less legs, to the point where soon they would have to break into a half-jog to keep up with it. Just when it looked like they were either going to lose their only promising lead so far or segue into an undignified chase scene, it became obvious where it was heading anyway. Humbledrum. 10 minutes later, Quentin was sitting in a booth in a dimly lit bar with a pint of beer on the table in front of him, as yet untasted. Though unexpected, this felt like a good development for him. Bar, booth, beer. This was a situation where he knew how to handle himself, whatever world he was in. If he'd been training for anything since he left Breakbills, it was this. Identical pints stood in front of the others. It was late afternoon, 5:30 or so, Quentin guessed, though how could you know? Were there even 24 hours in a day here? Why would there be? Despite Penny's insistence that the tree had been leading them here, it was pretty clear they would have found the inn on their own. It was a dark, low-roofed log cabin with a sign outside featuring two crescent moons. A delicate little clockwork mechanism caused the two moons to revolve around each other when the wind blew. The cabin was backed up against and appeared almost to emerge from a low hillock that humped up out of the forest floor. Cautiously pushing inside through swinging doors, they discovered what could have passed for a period room in a museum of colonial America, a long, narrow chamber with a bar against one wall. It reminded Quentin of the historic old inns he'd wandered through when he was visiting his parents in Chesterton. Only one other booth was occupied by a family, a tall, white-haired old man, a high-cheekboned woman who might have been in her 30s, and a serious little girl, obviously locals. They sat perfectly silent and erect, staring balefully at the empty cups and saucers in front of them. The little girl's hooded eyes expressed a precocious acquaintance with adversity. The walking birch tree had disappeared, presumably into a back room. The bartender wore a curious old-fashioned uniform, black with many brass buttons, something like what an Edwardian policeman might have worn. He had a narrow, bored face and heavy black 5 o'clock shadow, and he slowly polished pint glasses with a white cloth in the manner of bartenders since time immemorial. Otherwise the room was empty, except for a large brown bear wearing a waistcoat, sitting slumped in a sturdy armchair in one corner. It wasn't clear whether the bear was conscious or not. Richard had brought along several dozen small gold cylinders in the hope they would work as a kind of universal interdimensional currency. The bartender accepted one without comment, weighed it expertly in his palm, and returned a handful of change, 4 dented wobbly coins stamped with an assortment of faces and animals. 2 of them bore mottos in 2 different unreadable scripts. The 3rd was a well-worn Mexican peso from the year 1936. The 4th turned out to be a plastic marker from a board game called Sorry. He set about filling pewter tankards. Josh stared into his dubiously and took a fastidious sniff. He was as fidgety as a 3rd grader.
"Just drink it," Quentin hissed irritably. God, people were such losers sometimes.
He lifted his own tankard. "Cheers." He swished the liquid around in his mouth. It was bitter and carbonated and alcoholic and definitely beer. It filled him with confidence and a renewed sense of purpose. He'd had a scare, but it's funny how it, and the beer, were now focusing his mind wonderfully. Quentin shared his booth with Richard, Josh, and Anaïs. He had successfully avoided sitting next to either Alice or Janet or Penny. And they exchanged multiple transverse glances over their foamy pints. They were a long way from where they'd started out that morning.
"I don't think that bear is stuffed," Josh whispered excitedly. "I think that's a real bear."
"Let's buy it a beer," Quentin said.
"I think it's asleep, and anyway, it doesn't look that friendly."
"Beer might help with that," Quentin said. He felt punchy. This could be the next clue. If it's a talking beer, I mean a talking bear, we could, you know, talk to it.
"About what?"
Quentin shrugged and took another sip. "Just get a feel for what's going on around here. I mean, what else are we doing here?" Richard and Anaïs hadn't touched their drinks. Quentin took another big gulp just to spite them.
"We're playing it safe, is what we're doing," Richard said. "This is strictly reconnaissance. We're avoiding any unnecessary contact."
"You're kidding me. We're in Fillory, and you don't want to talk to anybody?"
"Absolutely not."
Richard sounded shocked. Shocked at the very idea.
"We've made contact with another plane of existence. What, that's not enough for you?"
"As a matter of fact, it's not. A giant praying mantis tried to kill me earlier today, and I'd like to know why." Fillory had yet to give Quentin the surcease from unhappiness he was counting on, and he was damned if he was leaving before he got what he wanted. Relief was out there, he knew it. He just needed to get deeper in, and he wasn't about to let Richard slow him down. He had to jump the tracks, get out of his Earth story, which wasn't going so well, and into the Fillory story, where the upside was infinitely higher. Anyway, the mood he was in, Quentin was willing to take any position on any subject with anybody if it meant he could pick a fight.
"Barkeep," Quentin said, louder than necessary.
As an afterthought, he gave himself a thick, Wild West drawl. "If it feels right, go with it." He jerked his thumb at the bear.
"Another round for my friend the bar there in the corner."
A bar in a bar. Clever. In the other booth, Elliot, Alice, Janet, and Penny all turned around in unison to look at him. The man in the uniform just nodded wearily. The bear, it emerged, drank only peach schnapps, which it sipped from delicate thimble-sized glasses. Given its bulk, Quentin guessed it could consume a more or less unlimited amount of it. After two or three, it ambled over on all fours and joined them, dragging over the heavy armchair, the only piece of furniture in the room capable of supporting its weight, by hooking its claws into the chair's much-abused upholstery and pulling. It looked way too big to be moving around in a confined space. The bear was named Humbledrum, and it was, as its name suggested, a very modest bear. It was a brown bear, it explained in deep, sub-sub-woofer tones, a species larger than the black bear but much, much smaller than the mighty grizzly bear, though the grizzly was in fact a variety of brown bear. It was not, Humbledrum reiterated periodically, half the bear that some of those grizzlies were.
"But it's not just about who's the biggest bear," Quentin offered.
They were bonding. He wasn't sure exactly what he wanted from the bear, but this seemed like a good way to get it. He was drinking Richard's beer, having finished his own.
"There's other ways to be a good bear."
Humbledrum's head bobbed enthusiastically.
"Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I am a good bear. I never meant to say that I'm a bad bear. I'm a good bear. I respect territories. I'm a respectful bear."
Humbledrum's terrifyingly huge paw fell on the table emphatically, and it put its black muzzle very close to Quentin's nose.
"I am a very respectful bear."
The others were conspicuously silent, or talked among themselves, elaborately play-acting that they were unaware of the fact that Quentin was conversing with a drunk magic bear. Richard had bailed out early, swapping places with the always game Janet. Josh and Anais huddled together, looking trapped. If Humbledrum noticed any of this, it didn't seem to bother it. Quentin understood that he was operating outside most of the group's comfort level. He could see out of the corner of his eye that Elliot was trying to shoot him warning glances from the other table, but he avoided them. He didn't care. He had to push things forward. He was afraid of staying still. This was his play, and he was playing it, and he was going to play it his way until it was played out. Everybody else could either get on board or button their candy asses on back to Drop City. It wasn't like what he was doing was easy. The range of Humbledrum's interests was suffocatingly narrow, and its depth of knowledge in those areas abysmally profound. Quentin still vaguely remembered being a goose, how laser-focused he'd been on air currents and freshwater greenery, and he realized now that all animals were probably, at heart, insufferable bores. As a hibernating mammal, Humbledrum had far more than the layman's familiarity with cave geology. When it came to honey, it was the subtlest and most sophisticated of gastronomes. Quentin learned quickly to steer the conversation away from chestnuts. "So," Quentin said, flatly interrupting a disquisition on the stinging habits of the docile Carniolan honeybee, Apis mellifera carnica, as contrasted with those of the slightly more excitable German honeybee, Apis mellifera mellifera, a.k.a. the German black bee. "Just to be clear, this is fillery we're in, right?" The lecture ground to a halt. Under its fur, Humbledrum's massive brow furrowed, producing a vivid equivalent of human befuddlement.
"What is, Quentin?"
"This place we're in right now," Quentin said. "It's called Fillory." A long moment passed. Humbledrum's ears twitched. It had impossibly cute, round, furry teddy bear ears.
"Fillory," it said, slowly, cautiously. "That is a word I have heard."
The giant bear sounded like a kid at the blackboard, hedging his bets against what might or might not be a trick question. "And this is it? We're in Fillory?"
"I think it may once have been."
"So what do you call it now?" Quentin coaxed.
"No. No, wait."
Humbledrum held up a paw for silence, and Quentin felt a tiny pang of pity. This enormous, hairy idiot really was trying to think.
"Yes, it is. This is Fillory. Or Loria? Is this Loria?"
"It has to be Fillory," Penny said, leaning over from the other booth. "Loria is the evil country across the eastern mountains. It's not like there's no difference. How can you not know where you live?" The bear was still shaking its heavy muzzle.
"I think Fillory is somewhere else," it said.
"But this definitely isn't Loria," Penny said. "Look, who's the talking bear here?" Quentin snapped. "Is it you? Are you the talking fucking bear? All right, so shut the fuck up." Outside the bar, the sun had set, and a few other creatures trailed in. Three beavers sipped from a common dish at a round cafe table in the company of a fat, green, oddly alert-looking cricket. In one corner by itself, a white goat lapped at what looked like pale yellow wine in a shallow bowl. A slender, shy-looking man with horns jutting through his blonde hair sat at the bar. He wore round glasses, and the lower half of his body was covered in thick, bushy hair. The whole scene had a dreamlike quality, like a Chagall painting come to life. In passing, Quentin noted how disturbing it was to see a man with goat's legs. Those backward-bending knees reminded him of the crippled or the gravely deformed. As the inn filled up, the silent family rose as one and shuffled out of their booth, their expressions still somber. Where could they be going? Quentin wondered. He'd seen no sign of a village nearby. It was getting late, and he wondered if they had a long walk ahead of them. He pictured them trudging down the grooved dirt road in the moonlight, the little girl riding on the old man's narrow shoulders, and then later, when she was too tired even for that, drooling drowsily on his lapel. He felt chastened by their gravity. They made him feel like a bumptious tourist, rattling drunkenly around what was, he kept forgetting, their country, a real country with real people in it, not a storybook at all. Or was it? Should he run after them? What secrets were they taking with them? When she reached to open the door, Quentin saw that the woman with the elegant cheekbones had lost her right arm below the elbow. After another round of schnapps and scintillating persiflage with humbledrum, the little silver birch sapling emerged from wherever it had been concealing itself and threaded its way through the room toward them, padding on feet of matted roots which still had clods of dirt clinging to them. "I am Farvel," it said chirpily. It looked even stranger in the full light of the bar. It was a literal stick figure. There were talking trees in the Fillory books, but Plover was never very precise in describing their appearance. Farvel spoke through what looked like a lateral cut in its bark, the kind of wedge that a single hatchet blow might have left. The remainder of its features were sketched out by a spray of thin branches covered in fluttering green leaves, which roughly limned the outlines of two eyes and a nose. He looked like a green man carving in a church, except that his flat little mouth gave him a comically sour expression.
"Please pardon my rudeness earlier. I was disconcerted. It is so rare to meet travelers from other lands."
It had brought a stool from the bar, and now it bent itself into a rough sitting position. It looked a little like a chair itself.
"What brings you here, human boy?"
"At last, here we go, the next level." "Oh, I don't know," Quentin began, casually throwing an arm over the back of the booth. Obviously, he was emerging as the designated point person, the team's natural first contact specialist. The bartender joined them as well, having been replaced at his station by a solemn, dignified chimp with a hangdog face. "Curiosity, mostly, I guess. We found this button that let us travel between worlds, and we were all sort of at loose ends on Earth anyway, so we just came over here. See what we could see, that kind of thing." Even half drunk, that sounded a lot lamer than he'd hoped. Even Janet was looking at him with concern. God, he hoped Alice wasn't listening. He smiled weakly, trying to play it cool. He wished he hadn't had quite so much beer on quite such an empty, weary stomach.
Of course," Farvel said companionably. "And what have you seen so far?"
The bartender watched Quentin steadily. He sat back to front on a cane chair, his arms resting on the seat back. "Well, we ran into a river nymph who gave us a horn, a magic horn, I think. And then this bug, this insect in a carriage, I guess it was a praying mantis, it shot an arrow at me that almost hit me." He knew he should probably be playing this closer to the vest, but which part should he be leaving out exactly? How did those calculations work? The rigors of keeping pace with Humbledrum had left him a shade less than razor keen. But Farvel didn't seem put off. He just nodded sympathetically. The chimp came out from behind the bar to place a lighted candle on their table, along with another round of pints, this time on the house. Penny leaned over the back of the booth again.
"You guys don't work for the Watcher Woman, do you? Or, I mean, like, secretly? Not like you want to, but you have to?"
"Jesus, Penny," Josh shook his head. "Smooth."
Oh, my! Oh, dear!
Farvel said. A charged glance passed between him and the bartender.
Well, I suppose you could say... But no, one shouldn't say, oh, dear, oh, dear.
Its composure thoroughly disrupted, the little treelet, the picture of arboreal distress, let its branches droop a little, and its green birch leaves fluttered anxiously.
I like a touch of lavender in my honey,
Humbledrum observed, apropos of nothing.
You want the bees to nest near a good-sized field of it, downwind if you can manage it. That's the real trick of it, in a nutshell.
Farvel wrapped one slender twig hand around its glass and tipped some beer into its mouth. After a visible struggle with itself, the tree spirit began again.
Young human,
Farvel said,
what you suppose is true in a sense. We do not love her, but we fear her. Everybody does, who knows what's good for them. She has not yet succeeded in slowing the advance of time, not yet.
It glanced at the humid green twilight forest visible through the open doorway, as if to reassure itself that it was still there.
But she hungers too. We see her sometimes from far away. She moves through the forest. She lives in the treetops. She hath lost her wand, they say, but she will find it again soon, or fashion a new one. And then what? Can you imagine it, that eternal sunset? All will be confused, with no boundaries to separate them. The day animals and the night creatures will go to war with each other. The forest will die. The red sun will bleed out over the land until it is white as the moon.
But I thought the witch was dead, Alice said. I thought the Chatwins killed her. So she was listening. How could she sound so calm? Another glance passed between Farvel and the bartender.
Well, that's as may be. It was long ago, and we are far from the capital here. But the rams have not shown themselves here for many a year, and here in the country, living and dead are not such simple things, especially when witches come into it. And she has been seen.
The Watcher Woman has, Quentin was trying to follow. This was it. They were getting into it. The sap was starting to flow.
Oh, yes. Humbledrum saw her. Slender she was, and veiled.
We heard her,
Penny said, getting into the spirit of it.
We heard a clock ticking in the woods.
The bear just stared into his glass of schnapps with small, watery eyes.
So the Watcher Woman, Penny said eagerly, is this a problem we can, you know, help you with?
All of a sudden, Quentin felt supremely tired. The alcohol in his system, which had thus far been acting as a stimulant, without warning, flipped to a chemical isomorph of itself and became a sedative instead. Where before he'd been burning it like rocket fuel, now it was gumming up the works. It was dragging him down. His brain began to shut down non-essential operations. Somewhere in his core, the self-destruct countdown had begun. He sat back in the booth and allowed his eyes to glaze over. This was the moment that should have galvanized him into action, the moment that all those years at Breakbills had been leading up to, but instead he was letting go, sinking down into dysphoria. Whatever. If Penny wanted to take this over, let it be his show from now on. He had Alice. Why shouldn't he have Fillory, too? The time for clever thinking had passed, anyway. The tree was clearly taking their bait, or they were taking its bait, or both. Either way, here it was. The adventure had arrived. There was a time when this had been his most passionate hope, when it would have ravished him with happiness. It was just so weird, he thought sadly. Why now, when it was actually happening, did the seductions of Fillory feel so crude and unwanted, its groping hands so clumsy? He thought he'd left this feeling behind long ago in Brooklyn, or at least at Breakbills. How could it have followed him here, of all places? How far did he have to run? If Fillory failed him, he would have nothing left. A wave of frustration and panic surged through him. He had to get rid of it, break the pattern. Or maybe this was different. Maybe there really was something off here. Maybe the hollowness was in Fillory, not in him? He slid warily out of the booth, rubbing up against Humbledrum's huge, scratchy thigh on his way out, and visited the restroom, a malodorous pit-style affair. He thought for a second that he might be sick into it, and that maybe that wouldn't be the worst idea in the world, but nothing happened. When he got back, Penny had taken his seat. He took Penny's place in the other booth and rested his chin in his hands and his hands on the table. If only they had drugs. Getting high in Fillory, that would really be the ultimate. Elliot had moved to the bar and appeared to be chatting up the horned man.
"What this land needs,"
Farvo was saying, leaning into the table conspiratorially and inviting the others to do likewise,
"is kings and queens. The thrones in Castle Whitespire have been empty for too long, and they can only be filled by the sons and daughters of Earth, by your kind. But,"
he cautioned them stirringly,
"only the stout of heart could hope to win those seats, you understand. Only the stoutest of heart."
Farvel looked on the verge of squeezing out a viscous, sappy tear. Jesus, what a speech. Quentin could practically have recited his lines for him. Humbledrum farted mournfully, three distinct notes.
"So what would this involve, exactly?" Josh asked, in a tone of studied skepticism. "Winning, as you say, those seats."
What it involved, Farvel explained, was a visit to a perilous ruin called Ember's Tomb. Somewhere within the tomb was a crown, a silver crown that had once been worn by the noble King Martin centuries ago when the Chatwins reigned. If they could recover the crown and bring it to Castle Whitespire, then they could occupy the thrones themselves, or four of them could anyway, and become kings and queens of Fillory and end the threat of the Watcherwoman forever. But it wouldn't be easy.
"So do we absolutely need this crown?" Elliot asked. "Otherwise what, it won't work?"
"You must wear the crown. There is no other way. But you will have help. There will be guides for you."
"Ember's Tomb?" Quentin roused himself for a final effort. "Wait a minute. Does that mean Ember's dead? And what about Umber?"
"Oh, no, 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 no,"
Farvel said hastily.
"It's just a name, a traditional name. It means nothing. It has just been so long since Ember was seen in these parts."
"Ember is the eagle?"
Humbledrum rumbled.
"The ram,"
the uniformed bartender corrected him, speaking for the first time.
"One of them. Widewings was the eagle. He was a false king."
"How can you not know who Ember is?"
Penny asked the bear disgustedly.
"Oh, dear,"
the tree said, hanging its vernal garlanded face sadly down toward the table.
"Do not judge the bear too harshly. You must understand we are very far from the capital here, and many have ruled these green hills, or tried, since the last time you children of Earth walked them. The silver years of the Chatwins are long ago now, and the years since have been forged from baser metals. You cannot imagine the chaos we have suffered through. There was Widewings, the eagle, and after him the Wrought Iron Man, the Lily Witch, the Spear Carrier, the Saint Anselm. There was the Lost Lamb, and the vicious depredations of the very tallest tree. And you know," he finished, "we are so very far from the capital here, and it is very confusing. I am only a birch, you know, and not a very large one."
A leaf fluttered to the table, a single green tear.
"I have a question," Janet said, unintimidated as ever. "If this crown is so damn important, and Ember and Umber and Amber or whatever,
are so powerful, why don't they just go get it themselves?
Well, there's laws,
Farvel sighed.
They can't, you see. There's higher laws that even such as they are bound by. It must be you who retrieve the crown. It can only be you.
We have lived too long, the bartender said glumly to no one. He'd been putting away his own wares with impressive efficiency.
Quentin supposed it all made sense. Ember and Umber absent, a power vacuum, an insurgent watcher-woman emerging from whatever witchy quasi-death she'd suffered at the Chatwin's hands. Penny had been right, after all. They'd gotten a quest. Their role was clear. It had a pat, theme park quality to it, like they were on some fantasy camp role-playing vacation, but it did make sense. He could still hope. But let's be sure. I don't want to sound crass, he said out loud, but Ember and Umber are the big shots around here, right? I mean, of all those people, things, whatever you mentioned, they're the most powerful? And morally righteous or whatever? Let's be clear on this for a second. I want to be sure we're backing the right horse, or ram, whatever.
Of course, it would be folly to think otherwise.
Farvel shushed him, looking worriedly over at the table of beavers who didn't seem to be paying them any attention, but you couldn't be too careful. Bizarrely, Farvel produced a cigarette from somewhere and lit it from the candle on the table, careful not to ignite any part of itself. It protruded jauntily from the tree's little cleft mouth. The thing must have a death wish. Aromatic smoke rose up through the leafy corona of its face.
Only do not judge us too harshly. The rams have been absent for many years. We have had to carry on without them, make our own way. The forest must live.
Elliot and the horned man had vanished, presumably together. Incorrigible, that man. It cheered Quentin up by a scintilla that somebody at least was having a good time. The white goat slurped its yellow wine loudly in its corner. Humbledrum just gazed sorrowfully into its schnapps. Quentin reminded himself, as if he had almost forgotten the fact, that he was very far from home in a room full of animals drinking alcohol.
"We have lived too long," the bartender announced again sullenly. "The great days are past."
They stayed at the inn that night. The rooms were carved hobbit style into the hill behind the main cabin. They were comfortable, windowless, and silent, and Quentin slept like the dead. In the morning they sat at a long table in the bar, eating fresh eggs and toast and drinking cold water out of stone jugs, their backpacks piled up in a heap in one of the booths. Apparently, Richard's gold cylinders went a long way in the Philorian economy. Quentin felt clear-eyed and miraculously unhungover. His restored faculties appreciated with a cold new keenness the many painful aspects of his recent personal history, but they also allowed him to really appreciate, almost for the first time, the reality of his physical presence in actual fillery. It was also detailed and vivid compared to his cartoonish fantasies. The room had the seedy, humiliated look of a bar seen in direct sunlight, sticky and thoroughly initialed by knife and claw-wielding patrons. The floor was paved with old round millstones, lightly covered with a scattering of straw, the chinks between them filled in with packed dirt. Neither Farvel nor Humbledrum nor the bartender were anywhere in sight. They were served by a brusque but otherwise attentive dwarf. Also in the dining room were a man and a woman who sat opposite each other by a window, sipping coffee and saying nothing, and glancing over at the Brakebills' table every once in a while. Quentin had the distinct impression that they were just killing time, waiting for him and the others to finish their breakfast. That proved to be the case. When the table was cleared, the pair introduced themselves as Dint, the man, and Fenn. Both were 40-ish and weather-beaten, as if they spent a lot of time outdoors in a professional capacity. They were, Dint explained, the guides. They would take the party to Ember's tomb in search of King Martin's crown. Dint was tall and skinny, with a big nose and huge black eyebrows that together took up most of his face. He was dressed all in black and wore a long cape, apparently as an expression of the extreme seriousness with which he regarded himself and his abilities. Fenn was shorter and denser and more muscular, with close-cropped blonde hair. With a whistle around her neck, she could have been a gym teacher at a private school for girls. Her clothes were loose-fitting and practical, evidently designed for ease of movement in unpredictable situations. She projected both toughness and kindness, and she wore high boots with fascinatingly complex laces. She was, to the best of Quentin's ability to gauge these things, a lesbian. Cool autumn sunlight slotted through the narrow windows cut in the heavy log walls of the two moons. Sober, Quentin felt more eager than ever to get on with it. He looked hard at his beautiful, despoiled Alice. His anger at her was a hard nugget he didn't know if he could ever digest, a kidney stone. Maybe when they were kings and queens. Maybe then he could have Penny executed, a palace coup, and definitely not a bloodless one. Penny proposed that they all swear an oath together to celebrate their shared high purpose, but it seemed like overkill, and anyway he couldn't muster a quorum. They were all shrugging into their packs when Richard abruptly announced that they could go if they wanted, but he would be staying behind at the inn. No one knew how to react. Janet tried to joke him out of it. Then, when that didn't work, she pleaded with him. "But we've come this far together," she said, furious and trying not to show it. Of all of them, she hated this kind of disloyalty to the group the most. Any crack in their collective facade was an attack on her personally. "We can always turn back if things get sketchy, or in an emergency we can use the button as a ripcord. I think you're way overreacting."
"Well, and I think you're underreacting," Richard said. "And I think you can count on the authorities to overreact when they find out about how far you're taking this."
"If they find out about it," Anais put in, "which they will not."
"When they find out about it," Janet said hotly, "this is going to be the discovery of the century, and we are going to make history, and you're missing out on it. And if you can't see that, I frankly have no idea why you came along in the first place."
"I came along to keep you people from doing anything stupid, which is what I'm trying to do right now."
"Whatever."
She put a hand in his face, then walked away, her own face crumpling.
"Nobody cares if you come or not. There are only four thrones anyway."
Quentin half expected Alice to join Richard. She looked like she was hanging on to her nerve by the very tips of her fingers. He wondered why she hadn't bolted already. She was way too sensible for a random lark like this. Quentin felt the opposite way. The danger would be going back or staying still. The only way out was through. The past was ruins, but the present was still in play. They would have to tie him down to keep him from going to Ember's tomb. Richard would not be dislodged, so in the end they set off in a loose pack without him, with Dint and Fenn walking ahead. They followed yesterday's carriage path for only a short while before striking out at an angle into the woods. For all the glory of their high and noble purpose, it felt like they were going on a summer camp nature hike, or a junior high field trip with the kids goofing off and the two counselors looking dour and superior and grown up and glaring them back into line when they strayed too far. For the first time since they came to Fillory, everybody was relaxing and being themselves instead of playing intrepid explorer heroes. Low stone walls traversed the forest floor, and they took turns balancing along them. Nobody knew who had built them or why. Josh said something about, "Where was the damn cozy horse when you needed it?" Before long, they emerged from the forest into a maze of sunlit meadows, and then into open farmland. It would not have been hard to get Alice alone. But whenever Quentin rehearsed what he wanted to say, however well it began, he got to a point where he had to ask her what happened with Penny. And then the dream sequence just went white, like a film of a nuclear blast. Instead, he made conversation with the guides. Neither of them was very talkative. Dint did show a flicker of interest when he learned that the visitors were magicians, too. But they turned out not to have much in common. His entire expertise was in battle magic. He was barely aware that there were other kinds. Quentin had the impression he was loath to give away any trade secrets, but he did open up about one thing.
"I sewed this myself," he said, a little shyly, pulling his cape to one side to show Quentin a bandolier-like vest underneath with many small pockets on it in rows. "I keep herbs in here, powders, whatever I might need in the field. If I'm casting something with a material component, I can just... like this." He executed a series of rapid pinching and dispensing motions that he'd obviously spent a lot of time practicing. "And I'm ready to go." Then the dour facade descended again, and he went back to his silent brooding. He carried a wand, which almost nobody at Breakbills did. It was considered slightly embarrassing, like training wheels or a marital aid. Fenn was more overtly friendly, but at the same time harder to read. She wasn't a magician, and she carried no obvious weapons, but it was understood that of the two of them, she was the muscle. As far as Quentin could make out, she was some kind of martial artist. She called the discipline she practiced Ink-Aga, an untranslatable phrase from a language Quentin had never heard of. She kept to a strict regimen. She couldn't wear armor or touch silver or gold, and she ate practically nothing. What Ink-Aga looked like in practice was impossible for Quentin to fathom. She would talk about it only in high-flown, abstract metaphors. She and Dint were both adventurers by profession.
"There aren't many of us now," Fenn said, her short, sturdy legs somehow devouring distance faster than Quentin's long, skinny ones. She never looked at him as she talked, her bulgy eyes continuously searching the horizon for potential threats. "Humans, I mean. Fillory is a wild place, and getting wilder. The forest is spreading, getting deeper and darker. Every summer we cut down the trees, burn them down sometimes, and then mark the borders of the woods. The next summer the borders are buried 100 yards deep. The trees eat the farms, and the farmers come to live in the towns. But where will we live when all of Fillory is forest? When I was a girl, the Two Moons was in open country." "The animals don't care," she added bitterly. "They like it this way." She lapsed into silence. Quentin thought it might be a good time to change the subject. He felt like a green-as-grass PFC from Dubuque, Iowa, trading banter with the hardened South Vietnamese regular attached to his unit.
"So I don't mean to sound crass," he said, "but are we paying you for this, or is somebody?
If we succeed, that will be payment enough."
"But why would you want somebody from our world to be king anyway, who you don't even know? Why not somebody from Fillory?"
"Only your kind can sit the thrones of Castle Whitespire. It's the law. Always has been."
"But that makes no sense. And this is speaking as the beneficiary of the law here."
Fenn grimaced. Her protuberant eyes and full lips gave her face a fishy cast.
"Our people have been slaughtering and betraying one another for centuries, Quentin," she said. "How can you be any worse? The rule of the Chatwins is the last peaceful time anyone can remember. You don't know anyone here. You have no history, no scores to settle. You belong to no faction."
She stared fixedly at the road ahead of them, biting off her words. The bitterness in her tone was bottomless.
"It makes perfect political sense. We have reached the point where ignorance and neglect are the best we can hope for in a ruler."
They hiked through slow-rolling hills for the rest of the day, their thumbs hooked in the straps of their backpacks, sometimes along chalk roads, sometimes cutting across fields, crickets jumping up out of the long grass to get out of their way. The air was cool and clean. It was an easy hike, a beginner's hike. There was singing. Elliot pointed out a ridge that he said was positively screaming to have Pinot grapes planted on it. At no point did they see a town or another traveler. The rare tree or fence post they passed cast a crisp shadow on the ground, straight and clear, like it was etched there. It made Quentin wonder how Fillory really worked. There was hardly any central government, so what would a king actually do? The entire political economy appeared to be frozen in the feudal Middle Ages, but there were elements of Victorian-level technology as well. Who had made that beautiful Victorian carriage? What craftsman wove the innards of the clockwork mechanisms that were so ubiquitous in Fillory? Or were those things done by magic? Either way, they must keep Fillory in its pre-industrial agrarian state on purpose, by choice, like the Amish. At noon, they witnessed one of Fillory's famous daily eclipses, and they observed something that was described in none of the books. Instead of being a sphere, the moon of Fillory was formed in the shape of an actual, literal crescent, an elegant silvery arc that sailed through the sky, rotating slowly around its empty center of gravity. They made camp at sunset in a ragged square scrap of meadow. Ember's tomb, Dint told them, was in the next valley over, and they wouldn't want to spend the night any closer to it. He and Fenn divided the watches between them. Penny volunteered to take one, but they declined. They ate some roast beef sandwiches they'd been saving since the house upstate, and unrolled sleeping bags and slept in the open, their bodies pressing flat, the tough, coarse, green grass underneath. Ember's Tomb. The hill was smooth and green. Set into its base was a simple post-and-lintel doorway, two enormous rough stone slabs standing upright with a third slab laid across them. In the space between them was darkness. It reminded Quentin of a subway entrance. It was just dawn, and the door was on the western face of the hill, so the hill's shadow fell over them. The grass was frosted with pale dew. There was no sound at all. The shape of the hill was a pure emerald green sine wave against the lightning sky. Whatever was going to happen here. They stopped and huddled 100 yards away, miserable and unshowered, to pull themselves together. The morning was chilly. Quentin rubbed his hands together and tried a warmth spell that only left him feeling feverish and slightly queasy. He couldn't seem to get oriented to Fillory's circumstances. He had slept heavily the night before, with vivid dreams, the weight of his fatigue sinking him down into dark, primal realms haunted by roaring winds and tiny, furry beasts, early mammals hiding fearfully in the long grass. He wished he could just stand here a little longer and look at the pink light on the dew. Everybody had a heavy hunting knife, which back on Earth had seemed beyond overkill, but now felt pathetically inadequate. The shape of the hill tugged at something in his deep memory. He thought of the hill they'd seen in that enchanted mirror in that musty little storeroom back at Brakebill's where he and Alice and Penny had studied together so long ago. It looked like the same hill. But so did a thousand hills. It was just a hill. "So, just to be clear," Elliot was saying to Dint and Fenn, "it's called Ember's Tomb, but Ember isn't buried here, and he's not dead." He sounded exactly as relaxed and unworried as he ever had back at Brakebill's, just dotting the I's, clearing up the details, the way he would have insouciantly picked apart one of Bigby's problem sets or decoded a closely written wine label. He was in control. The deeper they rolled into Fillory, the shakier Quentin felt. But Elliot was the opposite. He just got calmer and more sure of himself. exactly the way Quentin had thought that he, Quentin, would, and exactly the way that he wasn't.
"Every age finds a use for this place," Finn was saying. "A mine, a fortress, a treasure house, a prison, a tomb. Some dug it deeper, others walled up the parts they didn't need or wished to forget. It's one of the deep ruins."
"So you've been here before?" Anaïs asked. "I mean, in there?"
Finn shook her head. "Not this one. 100 places like it."
"Except that the crown is in this one. And how did it get there exactly?"
Quentin had wondered that same thing. If the crown really had belonged to Martin, maybe that was where he went when he disappeared. Maybe he died down there.
"The crown is there," Dintz snapped. "We will go in and get it. Enough questions."
He swirled his cape impatiently. Alice was standing very near Quentin. She looked small and still and cold.
"Quentin, I don't want to go in there," she said softly, without looking at him.
Over the past week, Quentin had devoted literally hours to fantasizing about what he would say to Alice if she ever spoke to him again. But all his carefully planned speeches fell away at the sound of her voice. She wasn't going to get a speech. It was so much easier to be angry. Being angry made him feel strong, even though, and this contradiction did nothing to diminish his anger, he was angry only because his position was so weak. "So go home," was all he said. That wasn't right either. But it was too late, because somebody was running toward them. The weird thing was that the entrance to the tomb was still 100 yards off, and Quentin could see the creatures coming the whole way, 2 of them, running flat out across the wet grass for at least a minute, like they were out doing early morning wind sprints. It was almost funny. They weren't human, and they didn't seem to belong to the same species as each other either, but they were both cute. One was something like a giant hare, squat and covered in gray-brown fur, maybe 4 feet tall, and about that wide. It hopped toward them determinedly, its long ears flattened back. The other one was more like a ferret, or maybe a meerkat, a weasel. Quentin tried to think what the closest equivalent furry animal would be. Whatever it was, it ran upright, and it was tall, 7 feet at least, most of it long, silky torso. Its face was chinless, with prominent front teeth. This odd couple came charging at them across the green grass, silently, no battle cry, no soundtrack, in the still early morning air. At first it looked like they might be running to greet them, but Bunny had short, stubby swords in both its front paws, held out steady in front of him as he ran, and Ferret was hefting a quarterstaff. They closed to within 50 yards. The Brakebills crowd shrank back involuntarily, as if the newcomers exerted an invisible force field. This was it. They had come to the end of what was conceivable. Something was about to give. It had to. Din and Finn didn't move. Quentin realized there wasn't going to be any parley or rock, paper, scissors. This was going to be about stabbing. He had thought he was ready, but he wasn't. Somebody had to stop it. The girls were hanging onto each other as if in a howling wind, even Alice and Janet. "Oh, my God," Quentin thought. "This is really happening. This is really happening." Ferret arrived first. It stutter-stepped to a jittery stop, breathing hard. Its huge eyes blinked as it smoothly spun its staff two-handed in a figure-eight pattern. It whickered in the still air. "Hup!" yelled Finn. "Ha!" Dint answered. They set themselves side by side, as if they were getting ready to lift something heavy. Then Dint stepped back, seeding first blood. "Jesus!" Quentin heard himself say. "Jesus! Jesus! Jesus!" He wasn't ready for this. This wasn't magic. This was the opposite of magic. The world was ripping open. Ferret fainted once and snapped a nasty jab at Finn's face. The two ends of the quarterstaff were now glowing an ominous, enchanted orange, like the tip of a cigarette. Somebody shrieked in the silence. Even as one end of the staff whipped forward, Finn turned away from it, bowing forward at the waist, ducking the jab and turning seamlessly, almost lazily, into a graceful, spinning, roundhouse kick. She seemed to be moving slowly, but her foot clocked Ferret's weak chin hard enough to spin its head around a quarter turn. Ferret grinned with blood in its big teeth, but it had more bad news coming. Finn was still spinning, and her next kick connected low and hard with the side of its knee. The knee bent in sideways, wrongly. Ferret staggered and aimed the same jab at Fenn's face, whereupon Finn caught the flashing quarterstaff bare-handed. The smack of it hitting her open palm was like a rifle shot. She dropped her slick martial arts elegance and tussled savagely, messily, for control. For a second they froze, vibrating with isometric strain, while Ferret, with agonizing, comical slowness, stretched its neck forward to try to bite Fen's bare throat with its big rodent incisors. But she had it outmuscled. Fen slowly forced the staff up under its chin, right into where its Adam's apple would be, while her right foot stamped pneumatically on the outside of its hurt knee over and over again. It gagged and twisted away. Just as Quentin thought he couldn't watch anymore, Ferret made its last mistake. It took its paw off the quarterstaff for an instant. It looked like it was going for a knife strapped to its thigh. With the extra leverage, Finn flung it down hard on the turf, and the wind huffed out of it. "Ha!" she barked, and stamped twice on its thickly furred throat, hard. A long, gargling rattle followed, the first sound Quentin had heard it make. Finn popped up, visibly amped, her face red under her blonde buzz cut. She picked up the quarterstaff, braced herself, and broke it over her knee in one try. Throwing the broken pieces aside, she leaned down and screamed in Ferret's face, "Ah!" The broken ends of the staff spat out a few feeble burnt orange sparks on the grass. 60 seconds had passed, maybe not even that.
"Jesus, Jesus, Jesus," Quentin said, hugging himself.
Someone was throwing up on the grass. It had never once even occurred to him to try to help. He wasn't ready for this. This wasn't what he had come here for. Meanwhile, the other assassin, the squat, muscular bunny, had never arrived on the scene. Dint had done something to the ground beneath its long rabbit feet, or maybe to its sense of balance, so that it couldn't seem to stand up. It was scrabbling around helplessly on the grass like it was wet ice. Finn, on a roll, stepped over Ferret's body toward him, but Dint stopped her. He turned back to the Brakebills crowd.
"Can any of you take him from here? Bow and arrow, maybe?"
Quentin couldn't tell if he was pissed that they weren't helping, or if he was just being polite, offering them a taste of the action.
"Anybody?"
Nobody answered. They stared at him like he was speaking gibberish. Every time the muscle-bound hare tried to get up, its paws kept flying out from under it. Chittering and weeping, the hare shouted a guttural cry and threw one of its swords at them, but it slipped again and the sword landed safely short and off to one side. Dint waited for an answer from the group, then turned away disgustedly. He made a quiet tapping gesture with his wand, like he was ashing a cigar, and a bone in the hare's upper thigh snapped audibly. It screamed in falsetto.
"Wait!"
It was Anaïs, pushing her way forward past a waxwork Janet.
"Wait! Let me try!"
The fact that Anaïs could even walk and talk right now was incomprehensible to Quentin. She began a spell but stuttered a few times, rattled, and had to start over. Dint waited, obviously impatient. On her third try, she completed a sleep spell that Penny had taught them. Bunny's grunting struggles ceased. It sagged onto its side on the grass, looking alarmingly sweet. Ferret was still gagging weakly, eyes open and staring at the sky, red foam pouring from its mouth, but nobody paid any attention to it. No part of it below its neck was moving. Anais went over and picked up the short sword the hare had thrown.